Imagine learning in a small group, intimate setting while exploring unique European locations. EU VetCE Experiences offers race-approved CE seminars that combine half-day lectures with time to relax and discover captivating cultures. The CE sessions are delivered in English, allowing you to elevate your career while vacationing with loved ones. Experience the perfect blend of learning and luxury at EU VetCE Experiences interactive seminars in hand-picked European destinations. Elevate your knowledge and recharge simultaneously. Visit euveterinaryce.com to learn more.
I've coined the phrase planned serendipity. In order for serendipity to happen, you've got to be receptive and put yourself in the right place to receive that. What may look like I had it all figured out is probably quite the opposite, but the secret is to be receptive to those changes.
Welcome to Vet Life Reimagined. I'm excited to share this conversation with you. Dr. Henry is very special to me. We met when I was in my clinical nutrition residency, and she was an oncology professor and the associate dean for research and graduate studies at the University of Missouri. We quickly became friends because of our common Auburn vet school background, War Eagle.
War Eagle.
I have been impressed with how she has supported those around her, her openness to innovative ideas for veterinary education, and how quickly people loved and respected her and her leadership at the University of Missouri. Dr. Carolyn Henry, as of this year, stepped down from being dean after 6 years. She started at the University of Missouri Veterinary School in 1997 to start the oncology service. I threw a few challenging topics at her because, one, I trust her greatly to provide us insightful answers, and two, I knew she had recently discussed these topics at a conference prior to our conversation. This is another fantastic episode, so let's get to our conversation with Dr. Carolyn Henry. When did you first know you wanted to get into veterinary medicine?
Oh, I was one of the kids that knew when I was very young. The first job I had, 12, and fortunate to have a veterinarian whose clinic backed up to our house.
Oh, wow.
And so I just went through the backyard over the creek and up to the clinic and asked what I could do. So I worked there for a few years, and then that just cemented that I wanted to do that for a career.
When you got into vet school, did you think you would do small animal? What did you think you might do? And did that change at all as you went through?
So I knew exactly what I was going to do, as many of us did. Right. I was going to get a practice on the Gulf Coast of Florida, small animal. And I was going to work there the rest of my life and have 2.5 kids and live happily ever after. I strayed along the way, apparently.
Yes, I do know you enough that that's not exactly how it went. Where did you grow up? I know you went to Auburn for vet school, but where did you grow up?
Well, my dad worked for Ford, so we got transferred quite a bit. I spent the most time in Kentucky, and that's how I ended up at Auburn, because they had a contract that they took students, a certain number of students from Kentucky would get in-state tuition.
Yeah. Okay. So you went to Auburn. You're going to be small animal practitioner. Well, what happened in vet school? What was your time in vet school like?
I loved vet school. Honestly, I mean, it was one of the hardest things I'd ever done. But just being with a group of people that was going through the same thing and just that camaraderie. I was in OTS veterinary fraternity, and that was my first experience with anything like that. I hadn't done rush or anything when I was an undergrad. So that, I think, was a wonderful experience. I didn't really change what I wanted to do while I was in vet school. I did get my first experience with cows, though. I'd never had any cattle experience. And, you know, it came down to having to go milk cows at the university dairy at 5 a.m. So that didn't turn me on to animal medicine, but it was fun to know that I could do something different.
Yes, I happen to know you're not a morning person, so that probably wasn't your favorite rotation. I, on the other hand, loved getting up at 5 a.m. to go milk cows. So,
yeah, no, not in the winter. I had the rotation in December, and
Ooh, and cold. So when did you start to think about specializing?
Actually, not until I'd been in practice about a year. I can tell the story of the mishap of my practice experience as well. I had decided that I wanted to work for somebody that had their own practice and had that business experience that I could learn from. I felt strong in my medical background, but not at all in business. And so I was looking at about three different practices in the Southeast, and I landed on one just outside Montgomery, Alabama. And the guy had had the practice for at least 25 years, single vet practice, small town. Everybody knew him. Everybody expected to see him when they came in. And so, you know, a little bit of trying to convince people that I was older than 12 and that I might know what I was doing. and went into practice with him. He, 3 weeks into that, he had a tractor accident, rolled a tractor over on his leg, had a compound fracture. He was diabetic. He got gangrene. They ended up amputating his leg, and he never came back to work. So my great plan of going to work for somebody that would show me how to run a business dissolved 3 weeks into the plan. And I was running a business as someone who didn't feel comfortable with their business background. So it was kind of a feet to the fire experience. And through that, I learned a couple things. First, you know, he tried to get me to buy the practice, and I decided I wasn't ready to commit to that at that time. And I also found that I really liked the oncology cases because it was kind of like solving a mystery. I didn't like the ones that had obvious masses per se, but ones that had paraneoplastic syndromes where they came in for something else and you had to kind of work backwards in that mystery. I just thought those were awesome. And so that's kind of what sparked my interest. That's what led me to go back to Auburn and ask if they'd consider starting a residency program.
Oh, so you started the oncology residency program?
Yeah, I wanted, at that time, I was now dating someone in that was at Auburn. And so I wanted to stick in that area. And they had three folks that were boarded. There was a surgeon, a radiation oncologist, and a medical oncologist. And they were all boarded, but they didn't have a residency yet. The specialty was only like a year old. And so I went back and said, you know, I will do it for free if you allow me to do some moonlighting at emergency clinics in Columbus, Georgia, and Montgomery, Alabama. And even with that, they weren't sure they wanted me, which is, I was like, but I'm free. And then they, when I got there, they had to pay me something so I could get a parking pass. So they paid me $1 a month, and I got my first check, and they had taken taxes out, and it was 88 cents.
So, oh, my goodness.
But, you know, that was like one of my favorite jobs I ever had. And to say you could get paid less than $1 a month and be having the time of your life, it sounds irrational, but I just really loved what I was doing.
And was your husband in veterinary, or what was he doing in Auburn?
Yeah, he was on faculty, so scandalous there. he was a food animal vet, so he's one that liked to get up in the morning and milk cows, and I did not. And he come from UC Davis, so he was a transplant to the South, as was I. And yeah, we ended up getting married before the end of my residency. And then we moved out to Washington State on faculty appointments out there as our first trip together, our first venture out.
Oh, I didn't know that one. So in Washington State, were you there to be an oncologist on staff, or?
Yeah, they too did not have an oncology program, and they wanted to start one. And he was food animal. They needed a food animal vet. They actually had me in internal medicine. And then I was to eventually build out an oncology program. But I ended up doing a lot more internal medicine than I had ever intended. I was teaching about diseases I'd never seen, like salmon fluke poisoning. I didn't even know how to pronounce salmon at that time. I kept calling it salmon. So it was a little uncomfortable being thrown into teaching topics that weren't oncology and were also ones that I wasn't that familiar with.
Well, I mean, that's a big difference between Alabama and Washington.
Oh, no kidding. Like,
the diseases you probably see, I mean, you didn't even get that. Probably some of those in vet school. So
yeah, and the cancers were different. That was what was really interesting to me. The way lymphoma acted was different, and I actually tried to map out the thyroid carcinoma cases because we had so many aggressive thyroid carcinoma cases in dogs in Washington I'd never seen in Alabama, and I did some research of why that might be, and as it turned out, thyroid cancer can be linked to volcanic eruptions. Washington State was downwind from the plume from the Mount St. Helens eruption that had happened about a decade before that. So it's kind of interesting to look at those things and then try to deduce if that's going to predict problems that could occur in people in that same area later down the road.
I was just about to ask, did you look at Sentinel? Like, would they be an example? Watching for that. That's fascinating. Well, goodness, does that start your One Health interest?
Yeah, it started my epidemiology interest for sure. And then I was also working with some researchers from the Seattle area. So I was linked up with Bristol Myers Squibb at the time. They had a immunotherapy unit out there. So that got me interested in doing clinical trials where we could treat dogs that had naturally occurring cancer. And learn from that potentially things that could go on and help people. So that kind of started my interest to some degree in One Health. Where the One Health really came into it was my husband, Jeff Tyler, passed away in 2009. And he had done a lot with trying to bring agricultural education to third world countries and work globally. And as an oncologist, I had no business really doing anything with that, but I wanted to see his programs continued. And this position came available at the campus at University of Missouri, working under the provost's office to kind of be a matchmaker for people that were in One Health that were at different colleges and didn't know that there were other people on the same campus that were doing work that related. So that was a super fun job. And it allowed me to do some of the things in One Health that Jeff would have wanted to see continued.
So is that what brought you to Missouri?
No, again, Missouri didn't have an oncology program. And so we had decided that there was an administration change at Washington State, and we decided that we wanted to look elsewhere. And at the time, there was a position for me at K-State, but not one for Jeff. And there was a position for Jeff at Mizzou, but not one for me. And both K-State and Mizzou came up with positions. And we went with Mizzou in the large part because of the med school. I was interested in having that connection. And they had been talking about starting an oncology program. And so that's what they hired me in to do. So I was kind of a guinea pig at three different institutions, I guess.
Well, I bet you we've learned a lot about starting programs and all sorts of things. So actually on that topic, you've been a teacher or some type of, you know, academic for a long time. So you talked about what you liked about oncology, but what kept you kind of in that teaching academia environment?
Well, you know, what I noticed in practice is I was the only one in the practice. And so whatever I said, people sort of believed it. and I could feel myself getting kind of intellectually lazy. Mm. And I liked being in an environment where you're pushed, where people question what you're doing. It's uncomfortable, but it kept me on my toes. And I always felt like I was getting better every day. And I think that has persisted in my 30 plus years in academic medicine. And, you know, likewise, I like pushing students. I like getting them out of their comfort zone, trying new things. with that safety net that you have in vet school. And then seeing those light bulb moments where things click, or, you know, you see a student that came in dreading being on oncology and then they decide, I want to be an oncologist. It's that kind of a job where you have an impact that can be really life-changing for students. And that's an awesome experience.
Do you have a particular story that stands out to you?
I would say more related to academic medicine than just oncology, but one that I found has made a big difference to a lot of students is just being vulnerable and admitting things that didn't work for me. And that started with when I took my national board exams back in the day. It was the NBE and then the CCT. It was a two-part exam. And I missed the score that I needed on the NBE to be able to practice in the state of Florida. So every state had a different pass point. And I was devastated. And I remember being at school and getting the results, and other students were all congratulating each other and so very happy. And I just wanted to go hide and not let anybody know. And then that also happened after my residency when I took the general exam. And in fact, I remember one of the internists from Auburn had said, well, you don't have to worry about the general exam because no one from Auburn has ever failed that. So I had to be the first at that too.
Oh, no.
I missed the general exam by 1 point. And then the next year I took both the general and the specialty exam, and I passed both of them. But again, it was that listening to people that were just overjoyed and just feeling like, man, I don't belong here. I don't deserve to be here. You know, I'm ashamed. And I've remembered that. And now when students get their board exam scores, I usually send out an email to the class and I just say, you know, just remember, if you're celebrating, that's great, but there's others who aren't. And if you're one of those people, that was me, and I'm here, you know, to say you can get past that, and I'm here to talk if you want to. And I think that's had a great impact on students that were feeling really down about themselves at that moment.
Yeah. Our profession tends to select for very high achieving individuals. And so when those things happen, we tend to beat up ourselves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so. I'm like, I always say I'm the poster child for imposter syndrome, and nothing cements that better than not passing a board exam.
Well, I've been there too. So you can put me in that.
Well, and it's, you know, it's interesting because my late husband, he had to take the general exam for boards, I think at least 4, if not 5 times. And nobody would know that. I mean, he was considered just genius level. But, you know, a lot of us aren't good at taking tests. We might be good on the clinic floor, but, you know, put us in a test situation and not so much. So I just think it's important that as leaders in the field, we're willing to admit that we're not perfect and we've had stumbling blocks along the way. And I think that makes it okay for students that are experiencing the same thing.
And actually, I think it's a great way to actually get more respect from people and trust as well. So they're more likely to come and talk with you because one, they know you've been honest, and but also you've been willing to show that vulnerability, so they feel okay to share.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you happen to get asked to be interim dean to start with, and you ended up being dean. So what is the journey to becoming dean of a veterinary university?
We would like to thank our sponsor, VetBadger, the all-in-one practice management software that puts relationships first. Created by working veterinary parents, VetBadger provides all the communication, team workflow, and medical management tools you need to run an efficient practice and get home to the relationships that matter most. In support of parents in VetMed, VetBadger will be offering a signed copy of the book, Pregnancy and Postpartum Considerations for the Veterinary Team, by Emily Singler, to everyone who registers for a demo between Mother's Day, May 12th, and Father's Day, June 16th. To register, visit vetbadger.com and find the link in the description below.
So again, it's, you know, usually when you put directions into your GPS, you know where you're going, you know your destination. And this was not my destination by any means. But when my late husband died, he had really wanted to be a dean. And I recall telling him that was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard of, that why would anyone want that thankless job? And he didn't get that experience. And I remember how much he wanted the position because he wanted to have an impact. And I like the idea of servant leadership and doing things that are going to have a longer lasting impact. To be quite honest, the only reason I ever applied for any deanship was I had several positions that were stipends, and that doesn't go into your retirement calculation. And so I was trying to get one salary, and I tried to negotiate that with my dean. And at the time, basically was told, well, you really need an offer somewhere else to have any bargaining power. And I had been asked to apply for a deanship elsewhere a couple of times and had said no, because again, stupidest idea I've ever heard. But I thought, well, I'll go ahead and pursue this and see if maybe that'll work. That actually, in totality, I applied over the years for 7 different deanships, had offers for 3 and withdrew from 1. I think what happened is with that first search, having people that could picture me being a dean sort of changed my self-perception, and suddenly I could sort of see it. And then as I, you know, started answering the questions of, you know, why do you want to do this? Of course, I didn't say I'm trying to get a raise, but my reason changed, and it became, I want to do something that's going to have an impact. And, you know, I could treat my 3,000th lymphoma patient, and that's going to have an impact for that family. But being in a position as dean, especially if you go into it for the right reasons, can have way more impact on more people and the profession in general. So when I was asked to be interim, I was like, well, this would be a good way to kind of try it out. And it was kind of unexpected, because nobody anticipated that our dean was going to leave at the time. I signed up for it, not necessarily thinking it was going to be where I'd land eventually, but turned out that way.
And you were with the University of Missouri for a very long time. And then also from a perspective of a dean, I'm curious, what is your thought about how veterinary academia has kind of changed over the past couple of decades?
Oh, well, you know, I would say the biggest change is just the information explosion. You know, when I was in school, I think I had 10 books on my shelf. And if I knew everything in those books, that was all I needed to know, right? You could not hold all the books of information that we have now. We also have the accessibility to that information right away. If you have something you don't know, you can always talk to your phone and you'll have an answer in 15 seconds. So I think it's changed how we look at curriculum, in terms of you're not going to have students that are going to be able to rely on rote memorization, one, to get through school, but more importantly, to survive in practice. We need to teach our students to be lifelong learners, how to access information, how to tell if information is accurate and worthwhile, to become very discerning in how we take in medical knowledge, and then trying to keep up with our clients, because clients have access to it as well. So you not only have to figure out what good information is, you have to learn how to dispel the bad stuff in a way that's not going to offend your clients. So tons of changes, you know, and it's going to continue with AI and all kinds of other things that are coming down the pike.
Yeah. And with the increase a volume of information, I can see how trying to create a curriculum that will prepare anybody who goes to any vet school across the country is going to have this level of standardization, like, you know, where we feel comfortable that everybody who graduates from a certified vet school will meet a certain expectation. So with that additional challenge, what is your thought about all of the different types of programs? Because, and I've had to, when somebody asks about vet school, I'm like, well, which one? Like, you know, some people do tracking where you decide kind of earlier in your 4 years that, oh, no, I'm large animal. I want to be on a large animal focus. I mean, there's so many different ways of learning and how to implement the information. So what are your thoughts about just the different curriculums and all of that?
Well, since you mentioned tracking, I'll start with that and tell you that I am not at all a proponent for that. I know too many people, including myself, who ended up taking a very different journey than we might have had we not had that broad exposure. And, you know, in my case, I stayed primarily in small animal, although really anything with cancer I would consult on. But having exposure to research, having exposure to specialists, I think all that's very important so that you know what your options are and you can reinvent yourself. If you, you know, start in one area and you don't like it, you can move on to a different one. So for that reason, I hope our education stays broad enough that students get that exposure. I think a difficult thing with the different programs, I mean, you've got the traditional programs that you could get all 4 years in one place. You've got distributive models, which in the past have been primarily 2 years in one place and then send them to another school for their clinical training. So the Caribbean school type model. And then you've got different distributive models that maybe they're going to practices that are affiliated. And I think in the future, there's so many vet schools coming down the pike as far as trying to get on the list to go through accreditation that are all going to be distributive or what they'll call hybrid if they've got some sort of clinical experience on site. I question where the students are going to go. You know, if we add 11 or 12 new vet schools, where is that experience going to happen? And how do we have some quality control over that? It's just so many different variables that it's hard to imagine students are going to get equivalent education. And maybe it doesn't have to be equivalent, but at some point you have to have some metric by which to measure success. And right now it's the NAVLE. And so if you're seeing big differences in NAVLE scores, that's going to get the attention of the accreditors with the AVMA and cause problems there. So, it, I mean, it's a very complex question, and it's something that I think is only going to become more so.
And you were just on a panel at the KC Animal Health Summit, and I know that kind of along these lines, there was a question that maybe one of the reasons that we have all of these new schools that are being proposed is around a veterinary shortage. However, is that even a problem? Is, you know, some people actually have that question. So in what you're seeing from an academic level as well, and you go to a lot of conferences and you get to talk with a lot of different people with different opinions, do we have a veterinary shortage?
That's the question of the month right now. I would say, you know, being with all the other deans through the AVMC, you know, you've got 33 deans from North America, and then you've got them from around the world. I don't think there's anybody in that group that doesn't feel like there's a shortage. And part of that is colored by the fact that, you know, a day doesn't go by that you're not getting a call from someone saying, how can I possibly get vets to come work for me? I can't get new grads. We hear that all the time. However, if you look at the stance that the AVMA is taking, they are less convinced that there's a shortage acknowledge and believe that it's more in part related to COVID and maybe something that's going to resolve when the pandemic is not as much of a problem, and that it's a problem of inefficiency in how we do our practice. I think the true issue is we have shortages in different areas. And I don't think the answer across the board is let's get more vet schools and let's increase class size. I think we've got to be very strategic about it. And, you know, how do we get students, for example, to go into rural practice? Just bringing more students in isn't going to necessarily achieve that. And you got to look at, okay, well, why do our graduates not want to go into rural practice? And it's not one simple answer. It may be, you know, maybe the schools aren't as strong. Maybe there aren't as many employment opportunities for a partner coming with. All kinds of things can affect people's desires for where they want to live. And so we've got to look at the bigger picture, and I hope we'll have a collective conversation between the two sides. Right now, I feel like we're kind of going off into our two different camps and hanging tough with our argument. I think we really need to say, what's the problem? You know, if there are shortages, let's identify where they are. And then how can we be strategic about meeting that need? And what are we scared of? There's always this, oh my gosh, we're going to put out too many veterinarians. And is that realistic or not? And I think something that's also changing is I don't think new grads necessarily want to work those same hours that a lot of the previous generations have done. Full-time equivalent or FTE, one veterinarian may not equal the same FTE today as they did 20 years ago. And so you may need to hire more than one veterinarian, which increases the need as well. So it's a complex issue, and it's one that I really hope we have a civil and productive discourse about it so that we can get some answers.
Other people's solution to a veterinarian shortage, but it's not just veterinarian, it's the whole team, mm-hmm. is to provide more opportunities for the veterinary technician. And so there's a lot of talk around a mid-level practitioner. There was the announcement that went out just a couple of weeks ago, I think, that it was kind of a, hey, we're going to actually do this. I think we're going to try to work towards this. And I know Missouri, I think you and I even spoke about focusing on opportunities for a veterinary technician program at Missouri. And so what are your thoughts? What are maybe some pros and cons when it comes to introducing a mid-level practitioner into veterinary medicine?
Well, you're hitting all the controversies today.
I did warn you. Yeah,
you know, mid-level practitioner is a dirty word in some groups. So, you know, the idea is, do we need something like a PA on the human medical side? And again, I think it's, let's look at what the problem is that we're trying to solve. And let's look at what are we afraid of if we do this? And I think one of the things that people are afraid of is that it'll take away from the respect and the recognition that vet technicians have, and it could affect their salary as well. On the other side, you could say, well, veterinarians tend to do a lot of things that probably aren't a good use of their time, that you could train someone in a PA type position to do, and then free that veterinarian up to do some of the more complex things or have those conversations with the owners in a more complete way. So I think what it hinges on is, what is that list of skills that we would feel comfortable handing over to I'm going to call it a PA, a VPA, that would distinguish them from vet techs? And do those even exist? Or is it just a matter of saying, let's all get on board with what being a vet tech means? You know, there's an argument there about whether we're going to call them nurses or techs. And every state has its own practice act, which really decides a lot of this. So we've got to be working with our state legislators, because it doesn't matter what AVMA or AAVMC or anybody else thinks, if the legislators can come in and change things, which is, you know, kind of what's happened in Arkansas, they've functionally created a position like this, and that could happen in a lot of different states. And then look at, okay, what is the future for our veterinary technicians? We increasingly have had to hire veterinary assistants because we can't get enough veterinary technicians. And does adding one more level just complicate that more? It could, but I also think a lot of our technicians leave veterinary medicine because they hit the ceiling. There's no place for them to go from there. So what we're trying to do at Missouri, and what I'm encouraging in different groups that I'm a part of, let's make sure we've got clear definitions of what is a vet assistant, what is a veterinary technician, and that can be registered, certified, or licensed, depending on what state you're in. And then what can you do from there? And certainly there are vet tech specialists that get specialized in certain areas. Oncology is one of those. But then what if they got a master's degree? What if they did continue education and went up to that next level? I would like to see that type of career ladder, because without it, we're losing people every year. I think that, the statistics are that most of vet techs get out of veterinary medicine in 3 to 7 years, and that's not sustainable. So let's recognize their skill set. Let's reward them for their education with salaries that match and the respect. Let's learn how to use them effectively to the top of their skill level. And then, I'm not personally opposed to having that next level, because I think there are some things that it could be very practical with. The big thing is understanding the level of supervision that's going to be required and understanding what that skill set's going to be. I think the concern is you're going to give VPAs the ability to write prescriptions, and they might make a diagnosis on their own that's incorrect and prescribe something. And then, the veterinarian is ultimately the one that'll be responsible. But I think there's ways to address that.
Yeah. And I like your name better. VPAs sounds better than mid-level practitioner.
It's just sort of gotten a bad.
So yeah. At least let's go with that name, if anything. No, I think back to your interest in being in academia, because you get to surround yourself with people who challenge you. It definitely sounds like you continue to do that. This profession has a lot of opportunity to grow. It's such a great profession. Again, we're a bunch of scientists, so we like to learn. We like to hopefully grow and get better. Yeah. We just got to do it together.
Yeah. If you look at what a vet tech can bring to your practice, they way more than pay for themselves. And I think it's on us as academic medical professionals to teach students how to appropriately utilize the skill set that the vet techs have. And if we go the VPA route, that'll be the same. I think vet techs need assistance, so that veterinary assistant should be helping the vet tech do their job. And I think that can have a continued effect as you go up each level.
I mean, I definitely have met many vet techs who they had far better skills than I did, or more of what I did. So yeah, yeah. I mean, we have some very, very, very talented people that I think any veterinarian who's being honest knows that they can't do their job without the whole team. So absolutely. You're part of big time conversations. You have a lot invested in early career veterinarians. What do you see as some of the things, just especially in early career, but in the profession in general, that you would like to offer some words of wisdom?
Adaptability is key to this profession. And, certainly we all learned that during COVID in a very real way. I do like to encourage graduates to be open to different opportunities and not beat themselves up if they get into something and it just doesn't feel right. You don't have to stay in it. I think that's the beauty of our profession is, gosh, there's so many different avenues, and that's only growing every year. If you look at pharmaceutical companies, pet food companies, private practice where you're an owner, corporate practice, specialty. I mean, the list goes on and on. And I admittedly am a bit of a short attention span person. So I get bored rather easily. And that's another thing I like about academic medicine is you're on clinics and then you're on research time and then you're teaching. I like to mix it up that way. But, you know, have some fun with it and don't feel bad if you find yourself in a situation that's just not a good fit.
With our ever more rapidly changing world, there are going to be jobs tomorrow that don't exist today. I think that's even for veterinary medicine and hence this podcast. So I'm glad that's your piece of advice.
Well, and you know, I think we need to embrace it. We can fight change all we want, but it's coming. Mm-hmm. So let's look at it and say, okay, how can we harness this for good? And I crack up thinking about, it was probably October, November of 2019. We were having a busy day at the clinic and I was in the deanship. But I remember seeing just tons of cars and I went over there and the waiting room is full. And I got a break and I went to McDonald's and I ordered ahead of time on my phone app and did the curbside. And while I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh my gosh, why don't we do this in veterinary medicine? Like, you know, if there's people that are sitting in the waiting room because they need dog food or they need to refill their script, that's silly. Let's think of an application like this for our vet hospital. And that seemed so bizarre to even bring that up at the time and was not, you know, the people that I brought it up with were like, yeah, well, then you got to have runners and, you know, and then we find ourselves 6 months later having to do that. And then a lot of practices, once they got used to it, didn't want to go back to how we were before. So, you know, I think it's just being open-minded and not being scared of change, realizing that every good thing that happens in your life requires some change and let's as a profession embrace that.
Was there anything else with the pandemic? I don't know. Bless the students' hearts who had to go through clinics during the pandemic, but like any... like big take homes from that experience, from your perspective?
Well, I think it's changed the way we teach, certainly in the preclinical years. You know, we went to Zoom, which none of us knew how to do in 2019 and didn't really know how to do it in 2020 either once we started. But it's changed how students want to learn. And it's changed the fact that a lot of them don't want to have in-seat classes. They want to do it on their own time, on their own schedule. So we're having to kind of recalibrate for that. And I think communication changed with clients. It was, you had to get all the information in the parking lot or over the phone. So there's just a lot of adaptability factors that came into it that I think have forever changed the profession, some for the better and some not. And yeah, our students certainly learned resilience. I mean, coming in and that being the start of your vet school curriculum, I cannot even imagine.
I can only imagine having to lead through that.
Well, we were going through our accreditation.
Oh, no.
So our visit was scheduled for May of 2020. And then it got postponed and then it got turned into virtual. And then after virtual, we had to do a verification on-site visit. So, I mean, our accreditation, I think, took about 2 years to get through the process. It tested us. But, you know, what's interesting is I think there were so many professors who had taught the same way year after year after year after year. And you know, we talked to them online learning. Nope, that's not my thing. Not going to do it. And it forced the issue. And once it did, there are some that said, you know, I kind of like having this as an additional way to teach. We had to break our anatomy lab and our surgery labs up into smaller groups and teach multiple times over the same. But, you know, the students also had more one-on-one with the instructors than they would have had otherwise. So there's some good things that came out of it, I think.
Well, that's good. Yeah, sometimes we do need the kick to change.
Right.
Well, fantastic. I have a final four questions for you. And the first one is there something that comes to mind that people may get wrong about you?
I don't know. I think in many regards, I don't know. This is my imposter syndrome coming out again, but I feel like I get credit for things that ended up looking like I planned them that way. And instead, I kind of fell into them, you know? So I've coined the phrase planned serendipity, because I think in order for serendipity to happen, you've got to be receptive and put yourself in the right place to receive that. What may look like I had it all figured out is probably quite the opposite, but the secret is to be receptive to those changes and make it happen. Yeah.
I think it's Oprah who says luck is hard work meeting opportunity or something like that. Great answer. Do you have a interest or a skill that maybe not a lot of people know about?
Some of the jobs that I've had that nobody would have thought of. And I think in many ways prepared me for the tortuous path I took in my career. I was a private investigator in Alabama. Uh-huh. And so I feel like I noticed things in settings that other people might not. I was a maid in a hotel when I was 15. So I've learned a few things there, you know, and then I did a lot of the things that you would think of for pre-vet, working on horse farms and vet clinics. I worked in cotton in Alabama as a cotton scout, counting boll weevils. So I think it's that diversity of background that people would probably be a little bit surprised by, but it also gave me great insight into a lot of different lifestyles. And it's, I think, made me more relatable with clients, or at least more empathetic.
So is that something maybe we should be more open to, like, as we're looking to, you know, bring in different individuals into veterinary medicine, especially when it comes to, you know, our diversity interest. I mean, is that something we should make sure that is okay and people are open to, and maybe we can encourage that for people coming in? It's instead Absolutely. Of spending every summer working with the small animal clinical veterinarian that's across the street, you know, is it okay to have private investigator background? Because psychology a lot. I mean, I think that's just being human psychology and being aware. What are your thoughts around that when it comes to like admissions? And
so first of all, I think every student should have two things before they go to college. Or at least earlier in their college career, they should have had a service job, whether that's, you know, waiting tables or cashier, what, just where you are working with the public and you're having to be kind to people that aren't necessarily being kind to you. I mean, I think that's invaluable, especially if you're going into practice. And I think it's really valuable for U.S. students to get outside the U.S., just to get that perspective. I think we have such a warped view of our country if we've only ever been in our country. And, you know, we think we can solve all the world's problems and we think we know better than other countries. And just to get out of that, I think is very valuable. And we've changed our admissions process to really look more holistically at life experiences and value diversity of background, diversity of opinion. So yeah, in that regard, I think it's very important. I do have one talent I just thought of.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's not a marketable talent, but I have always been able to find four-leaf clovers.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever found a four-leaf clover.
But I don't find them when I'm looking for them. Like I'll be running and I'll pass one and I stop and I back up. And I'll get it. So it's just something that
It comes back to what you were saying. You said you feel like maybe you get too much credit, but it's because you were, you know, you had worked to a certain part and the time worked out. And so back to your four-leaf clover. That's it.
There you go.
Goes deep.
Okay. If you ever need one, I can hook you up.
Is there anything on your bucket list that you would like to do?
Travel. Yeah. I got the travel bug early on. I think I had kind of a crazy aunt who was widowed at a fairly young age. She took one trip a year, and she would bring a stack of Kodachrome slides at Christmas, and my dad would bring home a projector from work, and we'd watch a slideshow, and I just like became engrossed in other cultures and, you know, architecture and all that. So my bucket list of places I want to go to is quite long.
I can relate to that for sure. And finally, what is something you are very grateful for?
Comes to mind right now is the fact that I had an acute spinal cord injury last summer and was paralyzed in May, and am walking today by the grace of God and by, you know, occupational therapists, physical therapists, surgeons, nurses, family, friends, colleagues. It's, you know, not something anybody could do on their own. And I'm just so grateful that I was surrounded by folks that helped me get there.
You have definitely have a lot of people who care about you. And so I'm glad you have a good team to support you as well in that. And I was kind of thinking back to when you were in private practice right out of vet school and the veterinarian had an injury and like everything changed. So,
yeah.
You know, things can happen so quickly. So, you know, having that support system is huge.
Huge. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I've had that several times in my life. So I think you're spot on with that.
Thank you for joining us on Vet Life Reimagined. Please make sure that you click the follow button on your podcast app to avoid missing one of our weekly episodes. I have a lot of wonderful episodes coming. If you would like to support this podcast, there are a few other ways that are 100% free. Give it a 5-star rating and review, and then subscribe over on the Vet Life Reimagined YouTube channel. We appreciate you and all your support. Until next time.